It is Friday, November 30th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offering a blend of local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. More information available online at nwaonline.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Charles Portis wrote more than just True Grit and four other novels. A new collection gathers his short stories, his journalism, and his only play together for the first time. We'll talk with the editor of that collection. Plus, the Little Craft Fair returns and more.
First, two public school districts will keep nearly $2.2 million in millage tax revenue, even though the amount exceeds the mandated school funding formula. That's after a split ruling yesterday by the Arkansas Supreme Court. Last year, the Arkansas Department of Education ordered the Eureka Springs School District and three others to return the overage, which was discovered the previous year. Most of Arkansas's districts take in less than the state mandated $6,023 per student from the minimum 25 mil uniform tax rate. But the Fountain Lake District in Garland County took in excess of nearly $1.4 million. The Eureka Springs District, more than $825,000 over a four-year period. Two of the districts agreed to return the money, but Eureka Springs and Fountain Lake filed a joint suit in May of last year against the Arkansas Department of Education. A Pulaski County Circuit Court ruled 4 months later in the district's favor. Yesterday, the Arkansas Supreme Court upheld that decision 4-3. Here is former Eureka Springs Superintendent Wayne Carr.
Well, I was certainly elated. I was very, very pleased, very happy for the school district, and I think it was the right decision.
The districts had received most of the funding already, so had the court ruled against them, they would have had to allocate and return it.
The tax money was electronically sent to the state, and required by law that the state electronically send it back to the county collector, and then the county collector wrote a check to the school district, so the state never could not hang on to that money, and that was our court case. They had no way of intercepting that money. So what money they did hold was some categorical funds, which is probably around $200,000. So they kept that, and now they'll have to turn that back over to the school district.
Governor Mike Beebe told reporters at the Capitol yesterday he sides with the dissent, saying the ruling could overturn a state constitutional amendment, which provides for equitably distributed school funding.
And I think Justice Brown, Justice Hanna, and Justice Ellis are 100% right. The majority, four people on the majority, have really set back what 25 or 30 years worth of court rulings and what the people did. You know, the people passed the amendment.
The court's majority opinion said the state constitution requires tax money to stay in the district where it is collected. The governor says the state is working on a petition for a rehearing of the issue.
As we originally reported yesterday, two firearms companies will add between 70 and 120 jobs to the Fort Smith area over the next 5 years. Umarex USA and Walther Arms, both owned by German company PW Group, plan to spend $7 million on manufacturing plants in the area. Governor Mike Beebe was there yesterday morning for the announcement at Chaffee Crossing. His spokesman, Matt DeCampbell, says these are jobs that could help bring jobs back to an area that has experienced recent losses.
Well, it's an announcement that would be great anywhere in Arkansas, but it's especially great for Fort Smith because Fort Smith, of course, is one of our manufacturing centers, and as a result, they've been hit with a lot of the problems that the manufacturing sector has seen, losing Whirlpool, some of these other big employers.
Umarex USA has already been in the Fort Smith area. It makes air gun and paintball guns and products recently entered into the firearm market.
Two Springdale businesses are subject of consumer protection lawsuits filed in Washington County Circuit Court yesterday by Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel. GYS Investments, an LLC, and Sonia's Tax Services allegedly offer to process applications for permanent residency under the Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors Act, commonly referred to as the DREAM Act. The proposed act would offer a path to permanent residency for immigrants who entered the country during their youth. However, Congress never enacted the DREAM Act, and Attorney General McDaniels states that the actions of the companies are deceitful at best, and at worst, the company's actions could lead to deportation proceedings or criminal charges against those whom they promised to help. According to McDaniel's office, the lawsuits ask the court to prohibit the two companies from advertising, providing, or charging for immigration services in the state. The suits also ask for civil penalties to be assessed and that the businesses be ordered to pay restitution to affected customers.
Forecast calls for cloudy skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, Saturday, cloudy with highs in the upper 60s to lower 70s. Tomorrow night, cloudy with lows in the mid-50s. For Sunday, cloudy with highs in the lower 70s.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Michael Tilley, the editor and publisher of the City Wire.
Well, it's good to be here. This feels weird talking to you face to face. I hope this goes well.
Well, we'll find out. Welcome to Northwest Arkansas. You come up here
frequently.
Yeah.
But just usually not at this time on a Friday. So.
And it's nice because this has been a big news week.
It has been. It's been a huge news week. And typically we know that between Thanksgiving and Christmas, everything slows down. So we were prepared for it to slow down. So we prepared the wrong way, as usual.
First, we'll talk about the Whirlpool plant deal, which was a little bit of good news in a bad situation. And now?
It's just another situation. Whirlpool, the thing with Whirlpool is Governor Beebe has even said it, so this isn't Michael Tilley, is that they need to get that building out of the hands, that 2 million square foot facility out of the hands of Whirlpool, because Whirlpool's made it difficult to recruit companies. They don't want a competitor in that building. Anybody that's even remotely attached to anything that Whirlpool does, they don't want them to have use of that facility. So it limits, obviously, who you can recruit. There was a company out of Ontario, Canada, Infinity Asset Solutions, had a pending deal to buy it. And Whirlpool announced prematurely that they had bought it, and Infinity said, no, well, not yet. Sure enough, the deal didn't go through. So we're back to the community in the States, back to working with Whirlpool. And if Whirlpool is as difficult to work with as I've experienced from the media side, if they're even half as difficult working on the economic development side, that's not a good thing for Fort Smith.
They do not have the reputation now as being a good neighbor.
No, I mean, more like a not even a neighbor. Like, you know, they've abandoned the property and it's
absentee landlord.
Absentee landlords are the best way to look at it. And I go back to Governor Beebe, who's very diplomatic. He's very careful in the words he uses. He's always been kind of down the road, doesn't want to pick sides. But when he comes out and says he's not happy with them, upset with them, and doesn't like working with them, and that they're not making it easy, then that must really be bad. So I just, Fort Smith, the Fort Smith area, all Arkansas, frankly, because when you lose that many jobs out of an area of Arkansas, it affects the whole state. So we need, hopefully this will change hands.
You mentioned Governor Beebe. He was in Fort Smith yesterday with an announcement of up to more than 100 new jobs.
Right, 120 new jobs. I was really, Walter. They make the pistol that James Bond uses in his movies,
right.
And I had asked BB's office if he would in any way turn around and pose like James Bond, but obviously we knew that wasn't going to happen. But we asked anyway. But yeah, Walter is in Umarex. They're co-located there at Chaffee Crossing. Walter has picked Fort Smith to be its North American headquarters. Good deal. And yes, over the next 3 to 5 years, could be 120 new jobs. And Kyle, these are not. These are not $7-$8 an hour jobs. These could be good white collar jobs, the thing that Fort Smith really needs. So it's a good announcement. They're going to make a $7 million investment in the facility. And I've talked to the chamber officials, Tim Allen and Paul Harville there, and they plan on marketing it also. Say, look, here's a global gun manufacturer, gun distributor with a good name. And they picked Fort Smith to be their North American headquarters. So they're going to market that. So there's some ancillary benefit there with that as well. But if there's a time that we needed some good news, it's nice to kind of end the year on a positive. And the chambers even teased that they have a couple other projects in the pipeline that could go. Now, they always preface it by saying that, just like with the Whirlpool thing, mm-hmm. anything could go south at the last minute, but we're still optimistic.
Unemployment numbers came out. They're up over the previous month for both Northwest Arkansas and the Fort Smith Metro, but down compared to last year at this time.
Yes. And again, Northwest Arkansas continues just to heat up. There was a slight dip In both the number, there was a dip in the number of employed in the area and a slight increase in the number of unemployed. Northwest Arkansas, we're not worried about. I mean, 5%. There were, I think, less than 35 of the 372 metro areas in the country that have that kind of – so they're doing well. But still in Fort Smith, I think we're 46, 47 consecutive months above 7%. The number of unemployed increased back over 10,000 in that metro area. So it's still struggling, and we're beginning to see it also, I think, in the sales tax collections. The collections were strong, relatively strong in the first 8-9 months of the year. We're starting to see it trend back down. So that's a sign. Sales tax collections are a very clear and direct sign of consumer confidence. So we'll see. And we'll see what the numbers are from Black Friday also to see if there's any sales there.
Finally, I have two questions about your reporter, Kim Souza. One, does she ever sleep?
No. She says she does. I'm starting to worry about her. I encourage her not to get burned out on me.
She covers a lot of things that happen in Northwest Arkansas. I bump into her at almost everything I'm at, and then I see her byline on about twice as many things that I'm not at. She has on the citywire.com right now an interview with Tom Coughlin.
Right, and I'm sure most of your listeners in Northwest Arkansas, probably around the state or around the area, remember him. He was the number two guy at Walmart, the vice chairman of the board. He was a Sam Walton protege. I mean, he came here at a very young age. Sam Walton handpicked him, and he began in helping work security for all the new Walmart stores as they grew out. And unfortunate end to his career, you know, pled guilty to the frauds, and he served his sentence, he served his time, and so he's free of that now, so to speak. But he had watched, and his family had read some of the stories we'd been doing on the Walmart, the supplier community, and felt that we'd be a good source for him to somewhat reemerge. And so Kim Souza, he agreed to an interview with Kim Souza, and we put that out on the CityWire, getting very interesting traffic, a lot of good feedback from that. So I thought it was interesting that he and Kim even said there was no animosity, no bitterness. He still respects Walmart, and even said he thinks the best days are still ahead for Walmart. So, you know, and he's working as a retail consultant. Obviously, he's got a little bit of expertise in that.
And still a relatively young man, early 60s. Right,
right. 63. And, you know, he told a good story about how the partnerships, and that's our focus with the supply side. We look at the suppliers to that Walmart engine. And he talked about how those relationships have to be good for both partners, and he learned that from Sam. You know, he had talked to they decided to buy a security company when they were first expanding, so they wouldn't have to buy all the security stuff from another company. They just cut out the middleman and buy the company. And he negotiated a $100,000 deal down to $45,000, and Coughlin thought Sam would just be real happy about that. And Sam said, "No, I appreciate what you did, but we're going to pay the $100,000 because if the $100,000 has to be good, that deal has to be good for both partners." And so he said that was one of the biggest lessons going forward. So interesting story.
Is that, when you started the CityWire.com, the sort of thing that, I mean, the supply side series, I mean, does being a web presence give you that sort of freedom?
Yeah, well, it does. It gives us that kind of flexibility. You know, it does. It takes zero production money, time, well, not zero time, but to turn a different angle like that. And we were encouraged. We were up here, and there were several folks, including Cameron Smith, who's been very generous with his time, who said, "Look, you know, I like all the stuff you're doing, but if you really want to focus on a niche up here that no one is covering, you need to look at the Walmart supplier community." And so we did, and all those folks who encouraged us to do that were right. It's been a huge benefit. We're getting a lot of great feedback, and we're getting feedback, interestingly enough, from the suppliers who we always thought just wanted to fly under the radar. They didn't want any press. And what we're hearing is that, yeah, they want their story to be told. And often, you know, there are 1,300-something companies up here, and they're all in their narrow little field with Walmart, so sometimes they don't know who the other players are in the supplier community. So we're starting to get feedback that they appreciate learning about other folks in the supplier community.
Finally, will we know the next time you and I talk who the next football coach is at the University of Arkansas?
Well, I've put my application in. I haven't heard back yet.
Okay.
So, but I think I could beat a Sun Belt Conference team.
Okay. There are several SEC coaches this year that did not.
Right.
Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. Charles Portis is best known for his novels. There have been but five, but they include Dog of the South, True Grit, and Norwood. An Arkansas native, he still lives in Little Rock and is considered by many to be one of the great American novelists of the last century, even if his name isn't as known as some of the other writers who would be put on such a list. Portis' written works extend beyond those novels. He graduated from the University of Arkansas with a degree in journalism and served as a newspaper reporter for the Northwest Arkansas Times, the Arkansas Gazette, and the New York Herald Tribune. During his tenure at the latter, he worked alongside other newspaper types, such as Tom Wolfe and Jimmy Breslin. Charles Portis also wrote short stories, essays, and one play. Much of his journalism and other short fiction have been difficult or nearly impossible to find, until the new book, Escape Velocity, A Charles Portis Miscellany, was published by Butler Center Books this fall. The collection was edited by Jay Jennings, a native of Little Rock. Jay Jennings will discuss the book tomorrow night at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville, beginning at 6 o'clock. This week, Jay told me the process of preparing material written by Charles Portis for public consumption was a labor of love.
I had a big file of stories of his that I'd collected over the years from, you know, a dozen different sources, and I'd occasionally just pull the file out and go back through them and, you know, read my favorite passages, and, you know, the file got dirty and tattered, and I had the thought a while back that I would love for them to be in book form where I could, you know, where I and others would be able to have easy access to them.
Many people, of course, know True Grit, know The Dog of the South,
right,
know Norwood. I think a lot of people who will pick this book up will be either reminded or perhaps even surprised. Yeah, Charles Portis was a journalist. I mean, he's a U of A journalism grad.
Exactly, yeah. And that was one of the surprising things that I learned in doing the book was what an accomplished and acute journalist he actually was in those early times, because the pieces, especially the civil rights coverage from the New York Herald Tribune in 1963, I had never read anything that he'd written for the New York Herald Tribune, and when I went back through the microfilm in New York and began to read that coverage, I was really struck by how amazing that coverage was, that he was right there with some of the greatest civil rights reporters of our day, like Claude Sitton from the New York Times, covering the most, you know, interesting events of that era, like George Wallace standing in the door of the University of Alabama to prevent black students from entering, and the murder of Medgar Evers, and the riots in Birmingham. And I'd known that he'd done some civil rights coverage, but I hadn't known that he had been there with his boots on the ground so close to all the action.
Well, and it's the great thing about having this book now, Escape Velocity, is so many of those articles, whether written by Charles Portis or another outstanding journalist, do kind of get lost into the, you know, only into the workings now of historians or people who are looking through special collections. It's great to have these works back out available to the public.
Exactly. Because I'd done a lot of reading in civil rights literature and history for Carry the Rock, and I'd known that he'd been a reporter, and yet I hadn't read his name in any of these accounts, not even in Diane McWhirter's, you know, book-length account of Birmingham's racial history. And his accounts were some of the most vivid and important reporting that was done. So I was really amazed when I came upon these pieces that they hadn't been anthologized or widely published before.
There are also short stories that I had never seen before, and just this, he could work, it seems like, in any medium, any written word concept, and he always knows exactly the right words and the exact right tone.
I think that's one of the amazing things about his writing, is that it seems so simple and effortless, and yet once you begin to look at it more closely, you see how you see the artistry of it. There's real artistry in making people laugh, you know, with such an easy hand. And one thing that the early stuff told me was that he had that ability, you know, right from the start. It certainly, you know, he certainly refined it and worked on it throughout his novels and throughout his later career when he was writing, you know, short stories and longer journalism travel pieces, especially. But yeah, it's almost a feat of magic. It's difficult to be able to look at it and see exactly how he does what he does, whether it's to make you laugh or to make you see vividly what he's seeing, or choosing just the right word. That's what makes a great writer.
And a playwright as well.
Yes. I'd known about the play, because when I was living in New York, I was sort of coming back and visiting family, and so I was kind of aware of what was going on in Little Rock through my parents and through reading the papers, and so I knew the play existed and it had been performed as a workshop at the Arkansas Rep, but I'd never read it or seen it. So when I got a copy and started reading it, I was, again, amazed at how easily he had mastered sort of dramatic form. And, he always wrote just the most amazing dialogue, so I can see how it wouldn't be such a great leap for him. But even the structure of the play is beautifully done.
The play was Del Rey's New Moon.
That's right.
And it wasn't, relatively speaking, it wasn't that long ago that it was workshopped by the Rep. It was in the 90s.
Yeah, it was 96, and they did about a two-week run. And I talked to Cliff Baker, who was the artistic director and founder of the Arkansas Rep, who directed it. And he worked with Mr. Portis on the play, and thought if he wanted to pursue it further, there would, be some things he might need to tinker with. But Cliff told me that he, thought that Mr. Portis was just happy to see it performed and put it aside after that to go, work on other things. But when I read it, I thought it was a really amazingly, fully realized piece of work, and some of the critics who had never read it before and who have reviewed Escape Velocity have felt the same way, and they think it's a sixth major work in addition to his five novels.
It's funny because when I was very young, the first two movies I remember my parents taking me to in the theater were True Grit and Norwood.
Mm-hmm.
So for a long time, when I was an adolescent, I assumed that everybody knew who Charles Portis was. I mean, after all, True Grit,
right.
John Wayne won the Oscar. Then I got older and got in college, and I assumed nobody outside of Arkansas knew who Charles Portis is. It's somewhere in the middle, because there is a legion of fans nationally and internationally.
Right. There seemed to have been a long period in the wilderness where the books were out of print, and they were, much like Portis characters, fans would hoard them, and we were like a secret society, who could bond over these obscure books. But in publishing Escape Velocity, it became clear to me that the fans were a much larger group than I had initially anticipated, and there were so many people who, just place him at the top rank of American novelists. You know, not not just regional novelist or southern novelist or western genre novelist, but at the top rank of American novelists, you know, living today. So I was kind of surprised by the depth of the cult and how many people were members of it.
Well, you mentioned a rare interview. He is quite known for not talking and not doing interviews.
Right.
I don't know if the term reclusive is accurate, but that is certainly the popular reputation that has developed around him.
Right. That seems to be, you know, that's kind of the go-to word for describing him. But I think it's more that he's just shy and private, and he wants the work to speak for itself. You know, he's around town. And my comment in the introduction was that, you know, to people in New York and Los Angeles, just living in Arkansas qualifies as being reclusive.
Right, right. You're already half reclusive just by being here. Yeah,
exactly.
Jay Jennings is the person who edited and put together Escape Velocity, a Charles Portis miscellany. He'll be at Nightbird Books Saturday night. Hey, Jay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Jay Jennings edited the new collection, Escape Velocity, a Charles Portis miscellany, published this fall by Butler Center Books. He's also the author of Carry the Rock, Race, Football, and the Soul of an American City, and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. He'll discuss his Charles Portis collection tomorrow night at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, beginning at 6 o'clock.
The second annual Little Craft Show isn't so little. It has practically doubled in size from last year, outgrowing the church it was held in and moving to the Fayetteville Town Center. The event is tomorrow from 10 to 6. It will showcase the works of over 50 independent artists from our region. I spoke with Lainey Butler, a photographer who will be selling her work during the show. Lainey began our conversation with an explanation of how she got started taking photos.
Well, I got started probably in my early 20s, about 16 years. I've been just taking photos all the time.
As a hobby?
Yeah, just, you know, I love taking, you know, camping and hiking a lot and like to take nature photos. And it's always just been a part of me. And here recently, the last probably 4 years, I've been sharing my work online with other photographers. And the last couple of years, I've just been concentrating on trying to get it out locally. So
you just noticed you had a good response from the photography community.
Yeah, I did. Online, I joined a group called Flickr, and, you know, I got a lot of response from photographers that, I looked up to and loved, and it just kind of gave me the confidence to keep going and, and then maybe, start showing it here locally, so...
Yeah. What was the process like applying for?
Well, they just, kind of asked about our work and how we got started and why we wanted to take part in it and, asked to see, photos of the work. And
it's a different process. A lot of the, like War Eagle, you pay for a booth.
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
really have to be accepted.
Yeah, exactly. And this, I mean, they... did as Amber Peridon and Natalie Freeman, they're the ones that got this together, and they've done a lot of hard work, and they spent a whole evening going through all these applicants. I'm sure it was really hard to decide, so they're all handpicked, and I think I've taken a chance to look at a lot of the vendors, and there's going to be some amazing artists and crafters there. So
when did you find out that you were chosen to be one of the...
I think they told us, I think it was the beginning of November, and I was pretty excited.
So that was just like 3 or 4 weeks ago.
I know, and I've been working like crazy to get everything ready because I didn't really want to do a whole lot until I knew for sure that, I was chosen. And so, yeah, it's been crazy 3 weeks.
So what kind of things have you been working on for the last 3 weeks?
Well, I make, usually I just was selling photography prints, and I thought, you know, I like those, but a lot of times I go to art fairs and I'll buy prints and then, you know, they never get framed or, you know, so I kind of was trying to think of something that people could just go home and set on their shelf or hang on their wall. So what I've been doing is mounting my photos to wood. The wood is stained around the side and it has like a archival varnish on it. And I mean, I think they look really nice. I've seen them. I'd seen people do this before and thought, you know, that's a cool idea. And so
that's a great idea because yeah. I personally, like you said, people buy prints uh-huh. and things and never get them framed. Yeah. And so I had prints sitting around my house for probably years.
Yeah.
Finally took them like 6 months ago to get framed.
Yeah.
And they're still not hanging on my wall, though. They're leaning against the wall.
I have so, you know, things I have like a stack of things to get framed.
Yeah.
But I just thought this would be a cool thing that, you know, people could just, you know, you can set them on the shelf or hang them up in groups or I just think they look really nice. And the way, you know, my work is nature, so I think they look nice on the wood, too, you know, so.
So where did you get the wood? Where?
Well, it kind of started out, my husband, we tried to go with circles at first because I liked the circle look and it just the way we were cutting on with different things, it wasn't working the way I wanted. So I ended up buying some that were, you know, not just kind of raw wood and they're birch. And then I just stained them and used those.
So you say that you do nature photography. Uh-huh. And Tim Ernst is a nature mm-hmm. photographer, a local nature
yes.
photographer. Do you take inspiration from
I do,
him?
And it's funny that you mentioned that because when I was in high school, this was back in, like, you know, 92, I saw one of his books in the library at my high school, and I've just followed him ever since. I read his blog every day, and I do. I would love to take one of his workshops someday, but he's definitely been a huge inspiration.
So, with your work, do you see some of he kind of does a lot of scenes?
Yes.
Do you do that also?
I don't. I mean, I would love to get into landscapes more.
Landscape. That's the word.
Yeah. I like a lot of details. I don't know if you looked at. Like butterflies, you know, like insects and even just little things that people may not notice, you know, when you're out hiking or something. Like just like I have a picture of an acorn and people love this photo. I love it too, but it's just the little details. It has frost on it and, you know, just I like to kind of get down on the ground and photograph the little things that maybe people don't notice as much. And
like when we're hiking and we you know, walk right
yeah.
past.
I know. There's so much beauty, especially in Arkansas. You know, I've spent, you know, my whole life here and hiking around the Buffalo River. And there's a lot out there to see, for sure. Well,
an acorn with frost on it sounds mm-hmm. very fitting for
yeah.
a winter market.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
In talking, you mentioned your blog, and I did too. But I saw something, there's a separate website that you're involved with. And it's like a word.
Uh-huh, words to shoot by.
Words to shoot by.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah, a friend of mine, she lives out in Utah. She put this together years ago. It was like her and a few girls. And they just give us a word every couple of weeks. And we all shoot three pictures of, you know, kind of our what we see in that.
I saw words like water and uh-huh. rainbow, and then for Thanksgiving there was
thankful. Uh-huh.
Have you had a favorite word?
I think travel was one of mine that I really liked. We were coming back from a trip, and we got behind a Volkswagen, and I was just taking pictures of it out the window, going around the curves, and the way the three pictures came together looked really cool, and that was, you know, my take on travel. So,
and then another one of the really great things about the little craft show is that people can meet the artists.
Yes.
You
yes.
will be there.
That's what I love about these, you know, these indie craft fairs is, you know, when you buy something from them, you know that it was, you know, handmade and you get to meet them and, you know, it's keeping it local and, that's one of the main things I love about this fair.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Lainey.
Thank you.
Lainey Butler is just one of many artists who will be showcasing their work at the Little Craft Show tomorrow at the Fayetteville Town Center. Other works will include printmaking, knit goods, stained glass, handmade clothes, and tons more. I spoke with Lainey earlier this week. For more information and for giveaways, visit thelittlecraftshow.com or like them on Facebook.
It is Friday, November 30th, the last day of November 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Bah humbug.
You are waving bye to November and don't like it?
Tired of the Christmas cheer.
What?
Yeah. Already? No, not really.
Oh, okay. I was
but
say,
I want to talk to you about a Civil War battle, which is not very cheery. So
no, but very timely.
Well, it's been 150 years minus a day or two since the Union and Confederate troops met in Prairie Grove. It was not a big battle. It was bloody, but it was decisive because it was the end of the Confederacy trying to get into Missouri.
I would say it wasn't big, relatively speaking.
Right.
It wasn't Antietam or Gettysburg.
Right.
But there were still casualties.
Yes.
Many.
Over
a lot.
2,000.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And so every even-numbered year, Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park has a battle reenactment. It just happens this is the 150th anniversary. So there will be cannons and camps and cooking and spinning and lace-making and a display of fought-in-earnest Civil War Arkansas, a traveling exhibit, all day Saturday and all day Sunday, and it's free. Parking is $5 a car. They say they have about 800 reenactors usually, and rumor has it about 3,000 coming in. So it'll be a big day.
And I have been to this before, and you have a lot of, what, audience or patrons, or I don't know what the proper term would be to watch a reenactment, but you'll have more this year as well because of that
landmark
anniversary.
Because it's 150th, right? Sesquicentennial.
That's correct.
Have you seen Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter?
No, I saw the Spielberg movie, Lincoln.
I haven't seen the Spielberg movie.
See that.
But the Vampire Hunter explains why the Confederacy really lost the Civil War.
Huh. I have the DVD sitting at home waiting to be watched.
I loved it. Moving on from my insanity, on to Christmas festivities.
Yes.
Shopping first, because it's my insanity.
Okay.
The Block Street Holiday Art Sale, which is now at Mount Sequoia, not on Block Avenue, is 7 to 9 today, 10 to 5 tomorrow, and noon to 4 on Sunday at Parker Hall. That's the first building on the left.
This has allowed them to expand somewhat?
They have a couple of guest artists. William Mays Flanagan is back. They have Denise Lanuti and Sabina Schmidt as guest artists.
Side note. Talking about Bill Flanagan,
mm-hmm.
Wednesday night when the moon was coming up and it was this bright orange and it was over the trees without leaves, I said, he's got to be out there painting right now.
Oh, Lord,
right?
I hope so.
Because
it looked like a Bill Flanagan painting.
It did. When I was driving home, coming up over Mount Sequoia, I looked at that and said, this looks stunningly like a Bill Flanagan painting.
Oh, there's all sorts of amazing stuff at this sale. Faye Alter will be there with her bags and Deborah Dubois with her weaving and a good time will be had by all. There's a holiday farmers market from 9 to 2 on Saturday at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks in Fayetteville.
Yep.
The Country Christmas Bazaar is from 9 to 5 Saturday at the Christian Community Fellowship Church in Siloam Springs. It's a fundraiser for the Siloam Springs Museum.
Okay.
The Holiday Bazaar is, of course, from 10 to 4 Saturday and noon to 4 Sunday at the Community Creative Center at Nadine Baum Studios.
Always like this one. Mm-hmm.
I will elbow my way in at 10 o'clock because I can finish my Christmas shopping. The Ozarks Chorale's Spirit of the Season is at 7 tonight at the Jones Center. And it is $10 for adults, free for children and students. Tomorrow is Breakfast with Santa at the Art Center of the Ozarks. If you haven't read today's What's Up, there's, if I do say so myself, a hilarious story about Santa's personal life. There are three breakfast seatings at 8:30, 9:15, and 10 tomorrow, and tickets are $15 for children and $5 for adults. Light Up Siloam Springs and the Siloam Springs Christmas Parade, 6 o'clock Saturday, obviously in Siloam Springs. Tomorrow night at 7, Sean Jones and his band will be at the Walton Arts Center.
Two shows, 7 and 9.
And Christmas Fanfare. The Art Center of the Ozarks Chorale is performing at 7:30 Saturday evening if everybody there lives through Santa.
Right. There you go.
And that's $8 to $12 for tickets.
And that is where?
At the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Very good.
After breakfast.
Right.
Right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, we have a name brand interview with Buddy Flett. I think of him as the Earl Cade of Shreveport, Louisiana. He stopped by the studios last month, brought a couple guitars. Check out that interview this Friday night at 9 o'clock on the Generic Blues Show. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, the managers of the Fayetteville Farmers Market, Lori Boatwright, Teresa Maurer. How are you ladies today?
We're great, thanks. How are you?
Very good. Now, the market, you know, on the square has kind of closed up shop for the winter. But you're still here to talk about something.
We are. We are here to talk about the market tomorrow. We're going to have a special holiday market out at the Botanical Garden. And we will have many of the square vendors out there that are familiar to people. So it'll be the whole range of things from crafts, some great Christmas ideas. We will have our meat folks and egg folks and our baked goods folks and some wonderful pies and all kinds of great things. And we will have some produce there. We have some vendors that have some hoop houses and ability to extend the season a little bit.
You say pies. Mm-hmm. What kind of pies are we talking about?
Apple and cherry, pecan. Mm-hmm. She does a berry pie. What else does she do?
She did a walnut pie, one of the last Saturday markets that was amazing. I don't know how much of that she's got left. But it's sort of whatever, you know, she's got available that she can find locally.
I don't know why walnut pie sounds so strange, because no one flinches at pecan pie.
Mm-hmm. This was a black walnut pie, so it was even more regional, local, and had a wonderful flavor. So I don't want to, you know, anticipate what she's going to have. That's part of the fun, is coming and seeing what pies she'll bring each week.
And so, I know she's also working on some handmade candies and things like that to have. So,
what are the hours for tomorrow's market?
We'll be open 9 to 2 at the Botanical Garden. The Botanical Garden also has several events going on that day. They'll have their Gardenland Express train set up for the kids to come see, and Santa Claus will be there. So you can come bring the kids to see Santa and have some milk and cookies and do some holiday shopping.
Is this a one-time event? Will this be on Saturdays until Christmas, or is tomorrow our chance?
Tomorrow is the chance for this special holiday market. We hope to have some news later about continuing markets. We're still working on that. So, but this will be a great chance, I think, to see many of the vendors that maybe people have missed over the last few weeks, for sure.
And what are farmers doing now?
Well, it depends. You know, if you're in the livestock business, you might be breeding to get ready to have new additions to your flock or herd next year. We have some of our chicken producers that will, you know, keep on producing for a little while. Our egg producers go, you know, all year. It'll drop off a little bit because of the day length. So other farmers, again, the hoop house farmers are, you know, planting to be able to have some early spring things. The other farmers, you know, there's always work that you need to do to keep the soil in the best shape possible and keep it covered during the winter and all those kinds of things. So it never really ends. You may not be going to market, but you're taking a breath and looking at how things went this year. You might be replanting your enterprise, doing all those kinds of things. So for farming, it really never quite ends.
9 to 2 at the Botanical Gardens, just like the markets work, pull up.
Yeah, it's supposed to be wonderful weather, and there is a nice paved path that will have vendors along, as well as a few out in the parking lot that have big displays, and then, as I mentioned, our food court vendors. So people will have a great experience to be able to walk through the grounds and the buildings and get to experience different parts of the holiday market. And we're really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be good. And some of our vendors were pretty excited this week when they called and said, well, I'm coming just because I want to see people. I've missed seeing people.
All right. Look forward to it tomorrow.
All right. Great.
Thank you both.
See you there. Thanks.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Wayne Bell. He is the writer of the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Did you have a good Thanksgiving week?
I did, and I hope our listeners from last week learned some Black Friday tips and get to enjoy the weekend.
On Thanksgiving Day, I did see Lincoln.
Okay.
And you saw it over the holiday weekend as well?
I saw it the Friday after, I guess. And yeah, I thought it was very good and a little nervous at first. I thought, oh, another Steven Spielberg movie. But after the first 10, 15 minutes, you sort of sink into it. And from there on out, I thought it was very well done.
And Daniel Day-Lewis, a front runner for Best Actor?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And, you know, winning that third one is always tough. And him and Sally Field both would be going for their third. So that would be a strike against them. But the other one, don't, you know, look out for is Tommy Lee Jones. He was excellent. And
right.
you know, he only has one. So maybe he can get his second. But it's a good movie and it's worth your money to go see.
All right. This is the time of year when many people start making their best of lists for music. You're interested in some people that were in music this year, but not necessarily people we're all familiar with.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and next week the Grammy nominations come out.
Which is earlier than it has been in the past. I mean,
yeah, and they always do like a big CBS-type concert to unveil them, probably because it's cheap, and so they throw this concert. And we know some things. We know that there's no Adele this year. There's no like central presence, but we know that a lot of people, Frank Ocean, Florence and the Machine, Gautier, they were all big this year in their respective categories. But the one that always strikes me is Best New Artist.
Which can always, it's a strange mix. You look back at the history of who's been named Best New Artist, of course, infamously, Milli Vanilli, Taste of Honey, remember them?
Mm-hmm.
Boogie, Oogie, Oogie.
Mm-hmm.
But then occasionally it's, you're quite pleasantly surprised. A couple years ago when Esperanza Spalding, this jazz artist, was named Best New Artist.
Yeah. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised about that. I just wonder, like, for a recording academy, that their music in general is dying in numbers. I mean, they could have maybe promoted somebody bigger. I don't know. I think it was smart to record. She's clearly the best musician there, but when have the Grammys ever cared about that before? They do have a history of, you know, for every Toni Braxton or Maroon 5 or Norah Jones, you know, you've got these Paula Cole and, you know, some people that you just, Shelby Lynn, you know, people that are more obscure and then they just kind of go away. And if you look back in history over the people that weren't even nominated because of whatever eligibility, like Lady Gaga, or they were nominated but they lost, like Kanye West and the Dixie Chicks and these people who became mainstays of the Grammys, it's really bizarre, that particular category.
It's an inexact science is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, who do you think might get nominations for Best New Artist this year?
Well, it's important to remember with the Grammys that, you know, you've got these voting bodies all over the country. So the Nashville music people will want to put somebody in there, New York, London, Los Angeles. And also remember that they try to have like one or two rock, one or two R&B, a classical or jazz, a country. So I would think this year, if you were looking at the possible contenders, we already mentioned Gautier.
Mm-hmm.
That song, Somebody That I Used to Know.
Great song.
Now and then I think of when we were together, like when you said you felt so happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me, but felt so lonely in your company. But that was love and it's an ache I still remember.
Yeah, it's bound to be up for Record of the Year, and probably Song. So I would think that they're a pretty strong contender. Frank Ocean, a hip-hop lyricist, poet, is bound to be up for Record of the Year or Album. So I would think that he's probably on good ground. Paul Sheeran, who's a British artist that I really like, he hasn't had the kind of success here that he had overseas, but he could potentially get in there, as could Fun. You home tonight. And I would think that the country music crowd is going to put in somebody like Hunter Hayes, who's kind of their version of Justin Bieber, much, much more talented, but a teeny heartthrobby, or the Lumineers, who are a great kind of folky country group that could get in there.
I've been trying to do it right. Hey! I've been living a lonely life. Ha! I've been sleeping here instead. Hey! I've been sleeping in my bed. Ha! Sleeping in my bed. Hey! Ha! Ha! So show me family. Hey! All the blood that I will bleed. Ha! I don't know.
The 5th is when the nomination concert is.
On CBS.
All right. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com.
Hello, this is Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On this week's program, I will once again feature an interview I did a week or so ago with jazz trumpeter Sean Jones. We'll hear how he came up singing in the choir at the church to a career as a leader and a band member of the Lincoln Jazz Orchestra. Also, in the second hour of the show, we'll hear music from Mal Waldron and Karin Allison, John Abercrombie, and much more. That's Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Garfield.
Garfield, right on the border. You asked a question yesterday. We were giving away 4 tickets to Any Area Malco Movie Theater and a wonderful edition of the Tim Hertz Calendar, the 2013 edition.
Yes. The Prairie Grove Battlefield is holding a reenactment of the battle that was fought there 150 years ago.
Yes.
And that's this weekend.
Yes.
So my question has to do with the battlefield. Right. How many buildings that are currently there were actually there when the battle was fought, when the original battle was fought?
Everyone who answered did answer correctly.
And the answer is one.
One. And it is the?
Borden House.
The Borden House. Johnny Bowen is randomly selected from the ceramic cow, and he actually named the structure,
right?
And we gave a bonus, didn't
we? Which means he gets 6 movie tickets.
6 movie passes and a 2013 Tim Ernst calendar. By the way, the Tim Ernst calendar for November of 2013, a wonderful picture from the Pea Ridge Battlefield Park.
Right.
Gorgeous picture. Let's give away a couple more tickets quickly.
Okay.
We'll give away 4 more tickets, another Tim Ernst calendar. We'll do this on Monday. You've got until Monday to answer at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. If I told you I was going to meet you at the 7 Points in Fayetteville, where would you meet me?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. This one's a little tougher.
I might be late.
You might be, because it goes by a more familiar name.
Okay.
We call it something different, but 7 Points was the original title. I'm going to meet you at 7 Points. All right. ozarksatlarge@gmail.com for the tickets and the Tim Ernst calendar. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Have a great Friday.
Happy Friday.